Welcome to those who have come to listen to the podcast today. We're delighted to have with us with Amy Small from Control Risk in New York. Amy joined us actually for two recent dinners, roundtable dinners in New York, where we were hosting both the asset management and the financial market COO community. We had two evenings. One was the first evening where, broadly speaking, it was those responsible for first line controls and conduct and the execution of, broadly speaking, the non-financial risk agenda. The second evening was the next level up with the global COO community or regional COO community, again looking at non-financial risk and looking at the spectrum of non-financial risk as it has evolved over the last 2 to 3 years. Particularly pertinent was that we were coming together at the end of one crisis, the pandemic, and immediately entering into another, the Ukrainian crisis, which obviously threw up different challenges, unique in context to the pandemic and not unique in relation to Ukraine and Russia, but actually the escalation and the breadth and the depth of sanctions, etc., is unique. So I'm delighted to have you with us, Amy. If you'd like to introduce yourself rather than me doing that for you, that'd be great.
Yeah, thank you, Maurice, and thank you very much for having me join this today. My name is Amy Small. I'm a principal with Control Risk. I've been in the risk management space for the better part of 20 years. Spent the earlier part of my career working in the government sector, mostly at the state and local level, and have spent the last 12 years or so both as a consultant like I am today, but also as a practitioner managing programs. My day-to-day work focuses on operational and enterprise risk, primarily around crisis management, business continuity, and overall resiliency. And look forward to chatting with you today, Mark.
Great, thanks, Amy. And I think what I'd like to do is almost take us on the journey of the two nights that you spent with us. And just put a little bit of context that Amy's part of Control Risk, where we have established a relationship over the last 2 years, and in fact have helped take us on a journey with the COO community from first line controls, then looking at threat management and then defining what threat management is and how potentially to manage or mitigate that risk. So this was like the next staging post for that conversation. So prior to you actually coming in, I'm just wondering whether you can give your views of how they were adjusted enough that you knew we're coming to a conversation about non-financial risk. You yourself have obviously got some specific personal experiences, but Control Risk has a tremendous amount of experience in crisis management, continuity management. But I'm just wondering what are the key takeaways that you took from the flavor of the conversations about where in an evolutionary perspective do you feel the financial services industry has got to?
Yeah, that's a really good question, Maurice. I think what we've seen is a bit of an evolution, right? I think from my own perspective, having been in this space for a number of years, we've seen a real shift over the years from kind of the focus primarily around financial risk and the need to manage that as a core part of your business, but to a movement around understanding the importance and the criticality around non-financial risk, and also at the same time kind of expanding what we mean by non-financial risk. I think traditionally it may have been thought about as a focus purely around technology and perhaps physical security, both areas that are still very, very important. But what I think what we've seen now is kind of a shift, more of a broader view around what non-financial risk means. Myself, and when I think about Control Risk, what we're doing is, you know, we start to think about both the kind of traditional non-financial risk elements, but we also think more broadly about operationally what it means to be able to not just prepare, but also to be able to effectively respond to things that may happen. So when risks actualize, when they happen, they impact your business, what does that look like? And I think, you know, what I saw, when there were a number of observations from both of those nights, but I think one of the observations that I took away for me was that people are starting to think about this a little bit differently. And we could talk about this, I guess, a bit more, but we're kind of in a unique place now, historically. And I think people are really starting to shift their focus and to think more about what it means to have effective crisis management, effective non-financial risk teams across the business, across the organization, within all three layers of defense.
That's a very interesting take, particularly through the lens that you look through it in relation to non-financial risk. And I suppose picking up on that is, having worked and supported the CRO community for so many years, when I look at, say, the evolution on financial risk, is that over the last 8 or 9 years, or probably since 2008, so much of the attention has been inward and backward looking, and looking at, say, human capital risk, you know, sort of the conduct issues, et cetera, cultural issues, reputational issues. And then we seem to have a pivot towards external threats like cyber, you know, for example, and then geopolitical risk. And how do you therefore translate geopolitical risk into non-financial risk? And in fact, almost all non-financial risk, you know, materialize as a financial impact. And I think that you're right in relation to, there was a flavor across the floor of different levels of evolution of thought, I felt, you know, from those that sort of are, everyone was managing non-financial risk, but I would say on the whole, my feeling was that it was done on a disparate, non-centralized sort of way, that each function was managing their non-financial risk and they were doing it more on a judgment-based as opposed to data-based for assessment. And over the conversation, I felt that when we were talking, that we would put up a couple of non-financials. I think you call the one that we talked about, culture and human capital. How is that a non-financial risk? And there was a debate about it, and certain number was steadfast at the beginning. Well, I don't really think it's non-financial risk. And by the end, they go, it is a non-financial risk. So it's almost as if I think that we need to re-energize the debate around non-financial risk. And part of that is actually defining the scope and breadth of non-financial risk. I mean, if we then take as an example, let's take about geopolitical risk as an example. We did run a session 18 months ago with controls risk, actually, where we put forward two scenarios. One was, what would happen if Taiwan was invaded by China? And the other was, what would happen if Russia invaded Ukraine? And at the time it was, yes, well, they are theoretical, but they're not, I suppose they're possible, but they're certainly not probable. And therefore, you know, our time has to be spent on base into putting out fires. And if we roll forward I'd love to say that I predicted it and we predicted it, but to a degree we had done. So when you look at the work you're doing around geopolitical risk, do you feel as if, having listened to that conversation, there is a greater appetite to be forward and outward looking as opposed to sort of inward and backward looking?
Yeah, I mean, you know, in summary, I would absolutely agree with that point. I think for us here at Control Risk, one of the things that we have focused on as a core part of our business has been geopolitical risk. And it's something that we study, it's something that we analyze, we look at trends, we look at kind of where the hotspots are around the world and what does that look like. And it changes year to year, month to month, week to week these days. But what we've really seen when we think about the evolution and how this can relate to non-financial risk is that you kind of had a smaller, if you will, market that was interested in understanding geopolitical risk and what it means to their business. And oftentimes it was tied to traditional parts of security within a global organization. But now you're seeing the business, if you will, the first line of defense, right? The risk owners really embracing an understanding of what geopolitical risk means for them, for their business, for their people. I also think part of this expansion, you touched on human capital risk. You know, they're understanding that this is not an abstract concept, right? This may be something that is happening in one part of the world, but it could potentially have a cascading effect that can impact their entire organization. It could impact their people. There's a continuity of operations perspective to this as well. What does it look like to our business, to our operations? What does it mean to our supply chain, right? To our critical vendors, et cetera. So I think, you know, we at Control Risk, we are clearly, obviously, at the moment, looking at the Ukraine-Russia conflict, and we're thinking very specifically about that, what that means. But I think if you step away from that conflict for a minute, you start to understand the importance of geopolitical risk to non-financial risk in a way that we haven't necessarily seen in a very long time.
Yeah, I think it's, having now put myself in that space, and then once you start looking at it, you can suddenly start seeing the consequence, the downstream consequence of what previously would have been sort of a headline comment about some geopolitical event. And I was just even thinking since we've had the conversations in New York, if you look, for example, Biden has made comment about India buying too much oil from Russia. India has come back and actually been actually quite robust about their independence of decision making. We then look actually that Russia and the Ukraine had become offshore low cost centers in relation to technology development. and then if you think about India itself, it's a huge center for low cost central outsourcing. And if you then tie this all to operational resilience, you can almost like see actually that the European countries are moving away from reliance on Russian gas and oil from a security perspective and looking elsewhere, you could even see that sort of the cost arbitrage or the labor arbitrage from actually low cost centers like India, etc. They're going to be weighing that up and going, okay, so geopolitically speaking, we cannot afford to have a portion of our service provision in a geopolitically sensitive area, and then having to onshore that, and then the cost consequence is going to be quite significant. So I think it's that sort of journey that I think, correct me if I'm wrong, though, I get the sense, though, that, you know, controls risk. I could imagine that you probably walk the carpets with the executive of many financial firms, you know, the CEO and the C-suite. But I just got the feeling that what that isn't is not disseminated down to those that have to execute the business, those that are actually at the heart of the business. So do you see the journey I've spoken about? Is that the journey that also you and control risks are going on in relation to how do we translate this further downstream to what does this mean for individual companies or sectors?
Yeah, that's a really good question, Maurice. I think, you know, to touch on that, I would say that's absolutely what we're seeing these days. I think, you know, to be a little more specific, right? Businesses have for a long time invested in resiliency, right? Invested conceptually in the idea of being resilient, the idea of managing risk, whether that's through mission statements or through strategic objectives of the organization. And those were set on high. There was an understanding. But what we're seeing now is that whether it's through the crisis in Ukraine and Russia, or even the pandemic that we're still living through over the past 2 years now, plus, is that there is a need to refine and understand roles and responsibilities at all levels of the organization when it comes to not just risk management, but crisis management. How do you plan, respond, and effectively and positively recover from these? We've been talking about these events, not just being kind of internally managed risk, but also the external world that you operate in. So when these things happen, because they do, right? How does a business manage through that? And for us at Control Risk, we've been spending a lot of time recently with organizations understanding roles and responsibilities. If you think about what this means in the COO community, the three lines of defense, understanding how do the three lines then interact in a crisis environment, right? Who are the teams? Who are the committees? How are decisions made? How is information passed up and down through the organization so that there is situational awareness to effectively and quickly make decisions at time of crisis? I think that's what we're seeing, a new kind of acute awareness around understanding what this looks like. And even if something exists on paper, I think we had some conversations over both of those nights about the idea of having a great plan that collects dust on a shelf, right? It was created at one time. Maybe it made sense, but it sits on a shelf. It collects dust. People don't know it exists. If they do know it exists, they don't know, you know, who are the teams? What does that look like? How do we come together? Again, separate. And I think what we're also seeing is that a shift from understanding non-financial risk in a BAU environment versus a crisis environment. And what does that mean? And it's kind of, we talked about the evolution earlier. I think that's also one of the significant and I think critically important shifts from kind of, if you will, the journey from 2008 through to where we are today.
That's, yeah, I think it's interesting perspective there, because I think you're right that the financial services industry as a whole had become very, very good at actually managing their business in a steady state. And actually, I use the term manage very specifically because I think what there's been a significant investment in management techniques and managing people as opposed to leading people. And I'm ex-military, so you're in the military, you're actually trained from a leadership perspective and you're trained specifically to lead in crisis. And I think if you look what's happened in the pandemic, there's been a move from managerial capability to leadership and to a degree empathetic leadership because of a hybrid working, etc. But I also think that it would be a falsehood if the industry said, yeah, well, we cope with that remarkably well, therefore we are adept at this at managing crisis. Because the sort of crisis that we're looking at, it does, in my mind, require a different mindset. It's not, and it's a mindset that can be trained. If you look at the military, you can create leaders. You can create a mindset in relation to crisis management. And a lot of it is actually, you know, by defined responsibilities. Yeah, but part of it is actually creating an innate self-belief in relation to empowerment, decision-making, etc. In fact, one of the COOs actually spoke about this specifically, identified, as you said, the difference in business as usual as opposed to crisis management. I suppose in the military, you'd have something like you'd actually have battlefield promotions in the military where someone actually demonstrates a level of leadership unexpected. But actually, that comes from training. And that when we listen to the debates, and then we're saying, well, actually, the unexpected people seem to step up. But what you'd ideally like to be in a position where people, yeah, they all step up because you've trained them. Can you, I'm just wondering, having had those two evenings, if you were then going to go in and sort of, if you were going to go in and respond to one of the COOs, what would you then say would be the key points you'd be looking at from a crisis management, from a training perspective? Where would you focus?
So the term that we heard in our conversations, which really resonated with me because we use the term ourselves, was the need to develop internal muscle memory in the organization to effectively be able to respond to a crisis. So what does that actually mean, muscle memory, right? You talked about the idea of, there's the concept of a BAU manager, somebody who can manage day-to-day effectively as part of their business operations. And then there's the manager in a crisis. And sometimes they are the same individual, but we oftentimes find that someone who may be a very good manager in the BAU environment struggles in a crisis. So I think part of what we do, this kind of a control risk, it's a two-part process. In the planning stages, we help organizations identify who should be the team members, who should be the functional experts, who should be the leader, who should be the coordinator, support people that will come together as part of that core team in a crisis. We help them understand what that should look like, what the representatives should be. We define those individuals in a plan or in writing. And then once that's developed, once that framework is put forward, we don't take anything for granted. We don't assume that what we've documented works. We actually run a crisis scenario, an exercise, whether that's a tabletop or a functional drill or some other type of environment where there's a training and exercising technique that we use, where we develop that muscle memory so that people have an opportunity in a safe environment to discuss via a tabletop setting, again, or a drill, a scenario that may impact their business. And you bring those people together that have been defined in that plan, and they have an opportunity to collaborate over a course of 2 to 4 hours through trainings and workshops. And what we find is, people walk away from those, even experienced leaders, experienced managers, saying, you know, I thought I had a pretty good handle on what I would do during crisis, but this has opened the door to a whole bunch of new things that I wasn't even thinking about, whether it's collaboration with this function or that function, or understanding my external risk environment better, or the need to speak with my team and explain to them what we would do and what would be expected of us should something happen, should there be a crisis, should there be an impact to our operations. We find that muscle memory development to be critically important so that when the time comes and there's a real crisis, that is not the first time you're getting together and saying, what are we doing? What does this look like? Who are we calling? Right. So we find that to be incredibly powerful. And it was really refreshing for me to hear that term being used by the audience over dinner.
Yeah, I actually think, having listened to you, that You're right. You mentioned earlier on about playbooks and how they gather books. So in fact, we mentioned on one of the evenings about who had a playbook for the pandemic, and that, well, most hands went up, and they all agreed to a single man and woman that every single playbook was irrelevant. So if we're looking about crisis management, what you're doing is actually creating a framework for any scenario. If you do crisis management training, so so that you can dovetail into that mindset and responsibilities, and then you then have to actually obviously adjust to what the specifics is, especially with that one. There'll be another military thing here. Field Marshal Slim, very famous British Army officer, he said the first casualty of war was the plan itself, and he said so. But what makes you operate after that is that you've all been trained to manage in a scenario within crisis. And you're empowered to make decisions within a crisis. So I think that's a very interesting outcome. I think from one of the things I certainly looked at was not so much the structure, but actually how do you empower and how can you coach and train individuals at every single level in relation to a crisis management perspective, which I probably think that whole idea about collaboration, communication would actually roll into their day-to-day activities anyway. Because they're not taught to think like that on the whole. They're quite sort of straight-jacketed. This is my role. This is my responsibility. That's my limit of exploitation. So maybe what we could do then next is, rather than embarking on this now, I know that we were going to do a couple of tabletop exercises, and I think what we'd be delighted to invite you to attend with those with the COOs, and then we could have a follow-on podcast to discuss what are the key observations that you took from, and you've done these exercises in multiple different sectors, and then we're going to apologize for the pun, but we're going to parachute you in to the COO community and to see what see what the reaction is about the specific or the nuances of that exercise. So I think that I would absolutely be delighted if we can do that. And I'd also like to thank you for taking your time out today. I mean, not just today, but also attending the two evenings. And I very much look forward to working with you in the future, and certainly going down this channel of training and looking to support the industry from a crisis management perspective.
Thank you, Maurice. It's been an absolute pleasure. I'm honored to be a part of this community. I think we are at a critical inflection point when we think about non-financial risk. And so I look forward to collaborating with you and your community and taking us down this path and building a more resilient sector as we think about the various ways that non-financial risk has developed and how we can adapt to the world we live in today. So thank you very much.
Thanks, Jeremy. I'll have to say it. God bless America.
Thank you. God bless America.